Well, we want to welcome everyone to our broadcast of our sermon today for Christ the King Presbyterian Church. And as we're all aware, I'm sure, this is Easter Sunday, and so a very special Sunday. And today we want to look at a passage in the Gospel of John. In his account of the resurrection, and we're going to look at verses out of chapter 20 of John, verses 11 through 18. And I want you to consider with me today the importance of response. The importance of response. I'm going to read this passage now. And as always, I'll invite you to listen very carefully, very intently to what is read, because it is the very Word of God. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. And as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." Having said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing, but she did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them, 'I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God.'" Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord," and that he had said these things to her. This is the word of the Lord. Let us pray. Heavenly Father, we ask that in this time, this ancient account of a magnificent event would touch our hearts and that we would be given grace to respond to it in a way that enables us and empowers us to live that new life that Jesus has given us. And we ask this in his name. Amen. Great events happen in history. But often, what's most important about those great events is not the events themselves. Pardon me. But the response to those events. Obviously, a great event that occurred in most of our lifetimes relatively recently was 9/11. And there were possible responses to that, responses of fear, responses of folding as a country, responses of panic. But fortunately, as we look back, that response, our response was largely positive. And there were many good things, actually, that came from that, even though it was, in fact, a tragedy. More pertinently, I think, more related to the resurrection, we could think of a positive event. And two positive events. We think of the world wars of the past century, World War I and World War II, and the difference of response to those victories of the Allies. The response to World War I was really a response that sort of rubbed the country of Germany's nose in the victory. And that response was not a good one because it led actually to World War II and a resentment of Germany that festered until the rise of Adolf Hitler, who was able to marshal a following largely because of the way that Germany was treated after World War I. After the victory of World War II, the response of the Allies was very different. And we embarked on a plan even to rebuild Europe and rebuild Germany and rebuild Japan, the Marshall Plan. That response has resulted in Germany and Japan, our enemies in World War II, becoming some of our greatest allies now. The response making all the difference. Well, the resurrection is a joyous thing. It is an incredible event, the greatest event, arguably, in human history. But the event itself is not sufficient. It's sufficient to accomplish many things, but very important is our response to that event. And I'd like for us to consider the proper response to the resurrection as we meditate on this passage, the passage that we've read today, and Jesus' encounter with Mary Magdalene. As always, I'd like for us to see three things as we look at this passage. First, I'd like us to see this in terms of a proper response. What is a proper response to the resurrection? First, I'd like us to see that we must have confidence in the certainty of the resurrection. Confidence in the certainty of the resurrection. Now, of course, our belief in the resurrection is based upon testimony. It's based upon accounts of this event. And we find those accounts, the only accounts that we have of the resurrection, at least the only ones that claim to be eyewitness accounts, and not of the resurrection itself, but of the risen Christ, of His presence alive after He had been crucified. We find those only accounts in the Gospels, in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, each containing an account. And accounts that recount for us different details of the resurrection. This is the only, John's account is the only account that that includes this encounter with Mary Magdalene, this personal encounter. And as is sort of the nature of John, there's a tenderness and an intimacy to John's account. But when we think of the fact that our awareness of the resurrection, our belief in the resurrection is based on these accounts, these ancient written documents, we might ask, how can I be sure that this happened? And of course, this is a very relevant question today because there are many today who would question the reality of the resurrection, the historicity of the resurrection of Christ. And this is a very important issue, a crucial issue, because as the New Testament informs us, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, our faith is in vain. Everything is based on the reality of the resurrection, everything that we believe and the certainty of everything we believe is based upon the fact that Jesus actually rose from the dead. Paul tells us as he begins his great exposition of his gospel in the letter to the Romans that Jesus was declared, not simply declared in an empty way, but declared with power to be the Son of God by His resurrection from the dead. In other words, we know that Jesus is the Son of God precisely because He rose from the dead. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then we don't have that validation, that verification that He is God and that everything He said about Himself and about us and about His mission and about what He accomplished, the very essence of Christianity is in doubt. Unless it was confirmed in reality by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But then the question remains, how do we know? These people gave testimony. They wrote down these accounts, but stories are written down all the time. How do we know it's true? Well, there are many things that could be said, but what we want to talk about today is what we see in this passage. And what we see in this passage is the type of account that would not be given unless it were true. In other words, if people made up these stories, if the writer, if John here were seeking to write an account that would exalt Jesus and draw followers to him and portray him in the best way, and so he made up the resurrection. If that were true, if this were just a legend made up by Jesus' followers in order to garner more followers, then they would have constructed the narrative in such a way that it would be the most credible imaginable. And yet we see at least a couple of things here about this narrative that give it the ring of truth rather than the ring of a fabrication. One thing is that Mary Magdalene, obviously, was a woman. And in the first century, women were not regarded as reliable witnesses. They were not regarded as believable or credible or competent as men. This was a common view in the first century. And in fact, in most societies in the first century, women were not admissible as witnesses in court. They were not regarded as reliable or credible. And it's interesting that in the providence of God, God arranged things in such a way that the first people to see Jesus, those who were the first witnesses to the fact that he had risen from the dead, were women. And Mary Magdalene was one of them, perhaps the first to see him alive and to give testimony of this to his disciples. It was women whom God chose and whom God placed in this very privileged position of being the first to see Jesus alive and the first to say, "It is true." And of course, maybe the first century attitude toward women was most obvious in the reaction of the 12 disciples when the women came and told them. They doubted. They couldn't believe it. We read in some of the other accounts in the Gospels. The testimony of the women wasn't enough. And yet, if someone were making up the story, these would have been the last people they would have chosen to be the first witnesses to the resurrection, the first people who testified of the fact of the resurrection. The very fact that this testimony is crafted this way means that it is almost certainly a reliable account of what really happened, of what actually happened. But then we also see this, that if this were crafted by someone who was making it up, that the nature of the story, the way that it's recorded, doesn't fit with what someone would say if they're trying to impress someone with the fact that it really happened. Part of that is in the way that Mary Magdalene reacts to Jesus, and the fact, most pertinently, that she doesn't recognize Jesus right away. Now, there are those who have come up with all kinds of alternative explanations for the accounts of the resurrection, that it really wasn't Jesus that was seen, but someone else that his early followers so wanted to believe was Jesus who had risen from the dead, that they mistook him for Jesus, and explanations like this. And these explanations have been around since the first century. Now, if I were a person who were making up a story about Jesus, making up the story of the resurrection, I certainly would not have had one of the most prominent witnesses, perhaps maybe the first person who saw Jesus alive, not recognize him at first. I certainly wouldn't have concocted that type of a story. Jesus here displayed probably what we see in other accounts, in other ways, that the resurrection body was not exactly like his body before. It had been changed in significant ways. The resurrection body had been exalted. This was a glorified body, not the first body. It was the same body, but it was a body that had been changed. It was different in significant ways. And this is manifested in other accounts in other ways. But this probably accounts for the fact that Mary Magdalene didn't recognize Jesus right away. But the fact that that's how it turned out, that the facts are related in that way, gives the story a ring of truth. It confirms to us that it is exactly the type of account that an eyewitness who really experienced these events would give, and not something that was made up. In other words, the truth was told. Whatever the consequences of that truth was, the truth is being narrated here. It is eyewitness testimony to what really happened that we have here in the gospel. The very nature of the account confirms that. Not long ago, I was watching one of my favorite old television programs, Gunsmoke, the old Western. And there was a story in which Marshall Dillon had a friend who was an outdoorsman, couldn't stand to be cooped up. Had been hunting and fishing with Matt many times, and this man was accused of having committed a crime that he didn't commit. And until they could find out whether this was true, he was locked up. Matt had to arrest him, put him in jail, and he escaped from jail. And before this could be resolved, because he couldn't stand to be cooped up, and he was afraid that he wasn't going to be able to exonerate himself. Of course, Matt tracks him down, and they're there on a hill, and the man's behind some rocks. He's got a gun, and he doesn't want to give himself up. And the man says, "Look," Matt says, "Look here, you've got to give yourself up." And he says, "I can't go back to jail. I can't face the prospect of eventually going to jail." For years and years, I couldn't live like that. I wouldn't survive like that. And Matt says, but I've got, you know, this is the right thing. This is the law. You've got to submit to the law. And the man says, if I put down my gun, will you let me go? And of course, if Matt wanted to let him go, if he wanted to just to get him to give up his gun, he could lie and say yes. And if he gave up his gun, say, well, I got to take you in. But he didn't. He said, no. He said, well, if I give up my gun, can you tell me that the judge will understand my story, will believe my story? And he could have lied and said yes, so to get him to give up his gun. But Matt says, no, I can't guarantee that. But I still got to take you in. And I would say, you got to give yourself up. And you see the man think for a second, and then he decides to give up the gun and to give himself up. And the reason being that Matt Dillon didn't lie to him. The fact that he told him the truth, even though the truth might cause him not to give himself up, might not be what would manipulate him. It was the truth no matter what. That was what caused him to believe that he could be trusted. And that's true here. We can trust the accounts that are given of the resurrection precisely because they don't try to manipulate the truth. The truth is given regardless of what our response might be to it. This is the truth. It's not watered down. It's not manipulated. The text is not seeking to manipulate our belief. It is simply the facts as they happened and we take them at face value. And we can take them with confidence at face value because of their very nature. They have the ring of truth. And that's important because our confidence in the resurrection is absolutely crucial to our faith. It's crucial to our continuing in the faith. It's crucial when life presses on us and when we are under pressure and we're under stress and we're tempted to think, what's the use? And why should I keep going? It's the reality of the fact that Christ rose from the dead and that all that He said about the purpose of life, about where we're going as Christians, is true. It's our confidence in the resurrection that enables us to persevere. So that confidence is very, very important. And our response to these narratives, to these stories, to these accounts, to these testimonies of the resurrection must be confidence. And that confidence is not misplaced. It's justified. But then secondly, we need to see this, that we must take comfort in the consolation of the resurrection. Comfort in the consolation of the resurrection. You notice in this story that Mary Magdalene is extremely distressed when she finds that with the other women, and that's narrated at the beginning of this chapter, that the tomb is empty. Mary stands weeping outside the tomb. Why is she weeping? Well, she's weeping because that body that they came to anoint was their last link to Jesus, they thought. Of course, so much was bound up in the death of Jesus for them and their experience. Jesus, for 3.5 years, and we don't know exactly how long Mary Magdalene experienced the presence of Jesus, but as one of His disciples, she was around Jesus a lot. She heard Jesus a lot. And His disciples depended upon Him. They came to have confidence in Him. This was one who had been with them and who had protected them and provided for them. We read of Mary Magdalene elsewhere that she was one from whom Jesus had cast out 7 demons. Jesus had rescued her from a life of absolute misery out of His love for her. We read stories about how the disciples were in a boat during a raging storm and they thought that their lives were at an end, and Jesus asleep in the bottom of the boat is woken up and they say, "Don't you care that we die?" And Jesus says, "Oh, you have little faith." And He calms the sea and they're amazed. This one had been with them for 3.5 years and they had been under His protection. There's something even more than that. You know, when Mary sees Jesus and she mistakes Him for the gardener, and she says, He asks her, "Why are you here? Are you looking for someone? Whom are you seeking?" And she says, "Sir, they've carried my Lord away. They've carried Him away. Tell me where you have laid Him if you have carried Him away, and I will take Him." She wants to take possession of the body. She wants to care for Jesus in this way. Even after He's dead, she wants to care for His body. She loves Him dearly. And Jesus could have said many things to her. There's something very profound about this encounter, something that I don't want us to pass over without noticing. Jesus could have said a lot of things. He could have said, "Mary, don't you recognize me? It is I. I'm alive. Rejoice." You know, there are lots of things that He could have said. He could have said, "Mary, you don't need to weep." He could have taken her by the shoulders and kind of shaken her a little bit and said, "This is real. I'm alive. Don't you see? Isn't it great?" But He only says one word. And it's all He has to say. He just says, Mary. He just says her name. And she understands. And Jesus' immediate words are, don't cling to me, because apparently her immediate reaction was to grab him and cling to him, to embrace him out of joy, out of relief, out of consolation. She was consoled. She was brought from weeping to unimaginable joy in an instant. But how? By the utterance of one word, by the utterance of her name, by the one who knew her and loved her. And that one word, bound up in that one word, was all of that knowledge and all of that intimacy and all of that love. That's what she was missing. That was that about which she was sorrowful. That's what had been restored to her. And the revelation of all of that was in that one word spoken by one who knew and loved her in an intimate fashion, as only one who knew and loved her as Jesus did could have uttered it, simply Mary. And she knew who it was. I know many of you, some of you, I don't say many of you, perhaps many of you had parents like I did. Some of you might not have. Everyone doesn't have great parents, but I had great parents. I don't say that to brag. I don't say that to gloat. But I say that to share this. When my parents passed away, it was very profound for me. And my mother passed away first, and that was a trial. But it wasn't as bad because I still had one parent left and my father was still alive. When my father died, I can testify, and I think I've spoken of this before, that there was a profound sense of loss. And it was a watershed event for me as an adult. Because when my father passed, there was this feeling that I really am now alone in a very real sense. Like I wasn't alone before. I'm alone in the world. Because when your parents are alive, if they're good parents, your parents are the people, the sole people that you know for sure, even more than your siblings if you have brothers and sisters, even more than them, because you don't have sibling rivalries with your parents. Your parents are the people in life that you know, of everybody you know. If there's nobody on whom you can depend, if there's nobody who loves you, you know your parents do. Your parents have provided for you. Your parents have sacrificed for you. I knew that if I had a need, my parents would give me anything they had to meet that need. And they had resources, and they were people to whom I could turn. They had resources, not only material resources, but resources of wisdom and counsel to whom I could turn. And when my father died, I realized, I had this profound sense of loss, because I realized there's nobody on earth like that anymore. And in a significant way that wasn't true before, I was alone. And if you've lost your parents, I think you know something of how I felt. You know something of that feeling. It's a watershed feeling. When you lose your parents, when they're gone, you feel this profound sense of loss, and you feel alone in a very real sense. And I think that's the closest I can come to describing the feeling that the disciples, including Mary Magdalene, must have had when Jesus died. This one on whom they could count, this one on whom all of their hopes were set for their future and the future of the world, this one that they hoped would redeem Israel, and all of the perhaps slight misconceptions they had about the role and the ministry of the Messiah, all of that was dashed when he died. And in a very real sense, they were alone in a way that they weren't alone when they had the presence of Jesus. And so they needed consolation. They needed to be consoled that all was not lost. They needed to be consoled with the truth that they weren't really alone. And when Mary realized Jesus is not dead, but He's alive. He's alive. In her heart, that sinking feeling, that loneliness, that sense of aloneness was alleviated. She was consoled because she wasn't alone. And what Jesus proclaimed to His disciples on the Mount of Olives before He ascended to heaven is true for us today. It's true for you when you feel alone, when you lack confidence, when you feel like there's nobody who really understands, there's no one who really knows you. There is one who knows you, and He is not dead. He is alive, and His promise is the same to you as it was in the disciples. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. I am with you. And the resurrection of Jesus means that we are not, as death does, we are not separated from Him. But He is with us now and forevermore. As the writer of the Hebrews said, having died once, death no longer has mastery over Him. As He proclaimed at the beginning of the book of Revelation, I was dead, and behold, I am alive now forevermore. Death no longer has mastery over Him. Jesus has conquered death, and He is with us forevermore. With all of His resources, all of the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, more than we could ever ask or think, is available to us in Him because He is alive forevermore. There is no greater consolation for us in this life. And so crucial to our reaction to the resurrection is that we take this consolation and that we realize and take to heart the presence of Jesus with us. One who knows not only Mary's name, but knows our name. And whatever your name is, He speaks that name to you as one who knows you intimately. And who loves you. As the hymn writer said, this is my friend indeed, who at my need His life did spend. That's who is with us forevermore. But then we need to see one last final point, and it is this. We must have confidence in the certainty of the resurrection. We must take comfort in the consolation of the resurrection. And we must draw courage from the consummation of the resurrection. What does Jesus immediately say to Mary after she realizes it's Jesus and yes, He has risen from the dead? What does He say to her? You know, there's so much we might imagine that He would say. And I can remember reading this account and thinking, this is the only place where Jesus does this. But Mary, as perhaps the first person who sees Him alive, what does Jesus say? What does He want to get across? What does He tell her to tell His disciples? He immediately goes someplace. He goes to His ascension. He doesn't even talk much about His resurrection. He goes directly to His ascension. He says to her, do not cling to Me, which is an interesting thing to say. More on that in just a second, just as an aside. But he says, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and to your Father, to my God and your God. Why does He do that? Well, it's because we need to think of the resurrection as inseparably joined to Christ's ascension to heaven. In fact, we might think of the ascension to heaven as the consummation of the resurrection. Jesus rises from the dead that he might ascend to heaven as the conquering king, as the one who has accomplished everything that God has for him to do. His death and his resurrection and his ascension is the consummation of that process. It's the consummation of his work and, in a real sense, the consummation of the resurrection. We read about this and the significance of it in Ephesians chapter 2. Before I quote that, I want you to notice that Jesus, in the way that he talks about the his ascension, is drawing the connection between him as our representative, as a man, as the last Adam, as the head of a new human race. He is emphasizing his humanity. How do you see that here? He is saying, go to my brothers. He doesn't say, go to my disciples. He doesn't say, go to my worshipers, go to my followers. He says, go to my brothers. And the writer of the Hebrews talks about how Jesus is one among many brothers because he has done something as our head, as a man. He's accomplished something for humanity, the creation of a new humanity. And that humanity is realized in him. Humanity's sin, all those who are united to Jesus, of whom he is the head, their sins are canceled. Their sins are atoned because they died, as Paul tells us in Romans chapter 6. Because they are reckoned as having died with him. We're united to Jesus in his death. But also we have new life. Why? Because we're united to Jesus in his life, in his resurrection. But then Ephesians also tells us that the consummation of that is that we've been seated with Jesus in the heavenly realms. What does Ephesians say after showing us our condition apart from Christ? We're dead in our sins and objects of wrath. It says, but God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ, even when we were dead in our transgressions and sins. It is by grace you have been saved. And God raised him and us up, raised us up out of the grave. Yes, that's the resurrection. But he raised us farther than just bringing us out of the grave to stand on the earth. He says, and he raised us up and seated us with him in the heavenly realms. In other words, that resurrection, that being raised from the grave, was a raising that took us not only out of the grave, but all the way to heaven, to the right hand of the Father, seated at the right hand of God the Father. That's where we are now, seated in the heavenly realms with Christ Jesus, because we're united to him, and that's where he is. That's why Jesus here says, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Yes, Jesus is God. Jesus is God the Son. But he is also a man. He became incarnate. And the man Jesus has a God, and that God is God the Father. And Jesus emphasizes that because it's as a man that Jesus ascends to the Father and is seated on the throne, because as we mentioned so many times in this church, the fact that Christ is king means that our kingship is restored, that our ability to exercise dominion over the creation is restored, just as God meant for us to have when he created mankind, when he created Adam. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. That dominion was compromised. That dominion was lost when man fell into sin. Jesus Christ has restored that dominion. He's restored that right to rule. in His people because we are seated with Him. Where? At the right hand of God. And where is that? That's on the throne. What did Jesus say, or what did God say in Psalm 2? He said His reaction, His response to the rebellion of the nations. Why do the nations rage and the heathen plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand against the Lord and against His anointed one. They say, let us throw off their fetters and cast off their chains. How does God respond? He says, the one enthroned in heaven, the king, the father, laughs. He scoffs at them. And then what does He say? What's His answer? What's His response to this rebellion of the kings of the earth and this alternate kingdom that they have set up under Satan? He says, I have installed My king on Zion, My holy hill. And He warns all the kings of the earth to kiss the Son and to submit to Him. Now, Zion was the mount where the temple was. The symbol of God's presence. And in the temple was the Holy of Holies. And in the Holy of Holies was the Ark of the Covenant, above which were the cherubim, representing the cherubim in heaven who surround the throne of God. And so this, in the Holy of Holies, there was this invisible throne of God, the presence of God, who was seated between the cherubim, in the Holy of Holies. This was the presence of God among His people. It was a representation of God's throne, the ark being His footstool. Representative, symbolic, in one sense, of the earth, which is said to be in Scripture God's footstool. This was the throne of God. And what God says in Psalm 2 is, I have installed My king, the Messiah, whom I have said, today I have begotten you. I've become your, you are My son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of Me and I will give you the nations as your inheritance, the ends of the earth as your possession. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. You will rule them with a rod of iron. And in Revelation chapter 2, in the letter to Thyatira, Jesus promises to the one who overcomes, the one who's united to Him, the one who has faith in Him, I will give authority over the nations, and He will rule them with a rod of iron. He will dash them to pieces like pottery. He quotes Psalm 2, and what is affirmed of Jesus as the one on whom God has placed on His holy hill, on the throne, says to us that that promise applies to us who are united to Him. Not just to Him, but to us. And in the next chapter, as if that weren't enough, in the letter to Laodicea, God makes it even plainer, saying, Jesus says, to the one who overcomes, I will give the right to sit down on My throne, even as I overcame and sat down with My Father on His throne. In other words, to whom, as the writer of the Hebrews, to the Hebrews says in chapter 2 of his epistle, to whom has God submitted the world to come? It is, the first and best answer to that question is, it is to Jesus, who has ascended to the throne. But we also have to understand that the Bible teaches that we are to reign with Him. He has made us kings and priests. We are seated with Him in the heavenly realms. And what does that mean? What does that mean for us? What's our response? I said we must draw courage from that reality, from the consummation of the resurrection. What's that consummation? The ascension. What does Jesus want His disciples to know? I'm ascending to the Father. What's the significance of that? The restoration of your rule. The restoration of your position. The position that God created you to be in. Not to be God We'll always be creatures. We'll always be subject to God. But what has God said? He wants mankind as His image bearers to rule over all of His creation. And so, as some theologians have said, when we think of American culture, when we think of the world, when we think of everything, we think of educational institutions, and we think of the world of art, and we think of the world of science, we think of politics, we think of Hollywood. Who has crown rights over all of that? It is Jesus who has crown rights over all that. Jesus owns all of that. But what does that mean if we're united to Jesus? If we're seated with Him in the heavenly realms, it belongs to us. God has given us these things. God has given us these institutions. God has said they belong to you. I've given you dominion over these things to rule for me, to reflect my glory, to reflect my character, to reflect my purposes. Now, we can think of ourselves as Christians, and we can think of ourselves as a beleaguered minority, and that all we have to do, all that we're supposed to do, is sort of hold out until Jesus comes back. Hold out against the onslaught of the world. Just survive. But I'm here to tell you, God has not called us to Himself simply to survive. God has called us to Himself, even now, to begin to exercise dominion. He's called us to Himself to begin to apply His rule to every area of life, to every institution of life. Why? Because it belongs to Him, and because it belongs to Him, it belongs to us. Because He's given it to us. It's our right. As the one who owns everything, as the Creator, has bestowed us this right and has given us the crown rights to it because of what Christ has accomplished for us, because of the resurrection and its consummation, the ascension. I think I've told this story. It's been years since I've told this story, but when I was in Arkansas doing campus ministry, I lived for a while with my wife in a house. It was right on, it actually was on campus. And there were buildings, campus buildings, all around the house that we lived in. And parking, as it always is on college campuses, was very, very sparse. And we lived in this house. And so the owner said, "Here, you have these parking spaces, and these are yours. These are your parking spaces. Now, you can't just park anywhere you want around here because the campus owns most of this area around here." And there's a sorority. It was a sorority house right behind us, several sorority houses. And there was a dorm right across from us. And on the street in front of our house, those parking places were reserved for people who lived in the dorm. And parking was slim. And there were times when I would leave the house and I would come back, and there would be people, our parking places were behind the house. There would be students and other people parked in our parking spaces. And I knew how slim parking spaces were and what kind of competition there was. And if I left early in the day, it was certain that someone who was coming to class or someone who was coming back to one of the fraternity or sorority houses would have parked in our space. And when that first happened, I would call up our landlord and I would say, "Hey, there's somebody in my space." And he got kind of tired of that. And I was kind of sheepish because I didn't, you know, the competition was really fierce for these parking places. And people would get mad at each other. And I was a little timid. And I would encounter people coming back to their car and I'd say, "Hey, would you, you know, these parking places are reserved for us. And see the sign that says the parking place is reserved here. Please don't park here again." And it was just ignored. And being nice didn't help. And I remember one time I called the landlord again And the landlord was really irritated with me for calling him, because I'd called him multiple times about this. And what's he going to do? Is he going to come out there and confront the people himself? And so finally, just out of his frustration, he says, call the cops on them. And just go out there and tell them this is your place and it's not theirs, and they can't park there anymore, and they're going to be towed if they ever park there again. And all of a sudden it hit me. Hey, you know, this is my place. Why am I timid? This place belongs to me. It doesn't belong to them. They don't have any right to be here. And I'm right to impose some consequences, because this is mine. It belongs to me. I pay for it. See, I believe, folks, that we're timid when it comes to the world and the institutions of the world, because we really believe that those institutions belong to the world. But what God says to us is that they belong to us. They belong to Christ. And because they belong to Christ and we are in Him, they belong to us. Doesn't mean that we're justified in breaking the law or taking weapons. That's not how we win the warfare, not with the weapons of the world. The Bible tells us that. But our confidence in proclaiming the truth of the gospel and the truth of the scriptures is at least in part dependent upon our awareness of Jesus' crown rights and of our crown rights in Him. Because those rights, those institutions, those things of the world have been bought and paid for. They belong to us because Jesus has paid for them. And He's paid for them for us. And our response to the resurrection and to its consummation, the ascension, must be to take courage, to have the courage of ownership, the courage of the position in which God has placed us. Why are we timid? Why don't we speak? Why aren't we bold? It's because we don't understand this. But the resurrection of Jesus Christ means that we can have confidence, we can take comfort, and we can draw courage. Because Jesus is ours. The Jesus who is alive forevermore.